Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Deep Thoughts. Today, we're going to talk about needful things. So, Stephen King wrote a book back in the 90s, I believe, called Needful Things. It was made into a movie. And, you know, typically he plagiarizes someone else's story arc, but he does a pretty damn good job expanding it, retelling it. He's just got that genius, so this was one of his better works. For me, it's around the time that I think he was being contracted too much. It was just too much on his plate, so he was unable to keep one story finishing well. Tommyknocker's ending, awful. Tommyknocker's story, awesome. Now, for those of you who haven't read this book or seen the movie or even heard about it, let me get you up to date on what's going on, because this is just the trailer to the book. This is a reason to buy the book and potentially a reason to see the movie, which has a fairly decent cast. It's about a medium budget movie, but I mean, you wouldn't want Stephen King's stuff to be terribly expensive, except for The Shining, of which Stephen made a complete ass out of himself by trying to take a shit on Shakespeare, aka Kubrick. There's a little country town, and a new pawn shop opens up. And people are interested. People go down. They want to see what the old man's got for sale. And each one of the visits are pretty much the same. There's almost nothing in the store upon each person's arrival, except the one thing that the person who's visiting would die for. And, of course, the thing that they're looking at, they know they can't afford it. I mean, in their mind, they absolutely would do anything for it. And this gentleman behind the counter knows that. But he's cool. He wants you to have what you want. So he says, okay, how much money you got in your pocket? Oh, you know, a few bucks. All right, well, why don't you give me the few bucks? Then maybe you can just do me a favor. Okay. These people willing to do any favors. And the favors he asks for, at least initially, they're very benign. Well, you know, I won't tell you anything he tells them to do, but it's something really simple. It might be like, you know, take that bucket from right there and move it over there. And they're like, really? That's it? And I have this thing of my dreams? Yeah. Now, here's the kicker on the setup of the trailer, which should entice you if you haven't read it. The dude behind the counter is the devil. And those little things that people are doing that they don't think mean anything, no one's getting hurt, starts a war between the people of this city, of this town. And the rest you'll have to watch by yourself. It's beautifully written. I think the book is beautifully written because it's concise. It doesn't go on and on like The Stand, which has its moments as well. But the reason why I want to make this video is that even though the book Needful Things is a fictional creation, I think we all have a needful thing or things. And I believe that until we recognize the lunacy of some of our devotions, they rule our lives. And those who have those things can rule our lives. I've been toying with the notion of creating an episode called Haves and Have-Nots. My goal in my mind would be to entice anyone who is constantly strapped for cash, maybe, you know, living in a more urban district, maybe even, dare we say, ghetto district. It doesn't really matter. You could be living in a generally well-accepted area, but you're just potentially more broke than someone else. Or you could be fairly well-off. You could be upper-middle class, but you see stuff in the upper-upper class that you want. Now, let me preface this whole thing by saying some of you know that lusting after something can be an interesting goal for you and your family, and it's healthy. You're going to save up your money, and you're going to buy it when you have the money, like Gene Simmons from Kiss always says. He said he never has had a credit card. He only buys what he can afford. I think Groucho Marx said that as well, because the Marx brothers, living in New York, they didn't grow up in some super affluent family, plus a ton of kids. I'm sure it was very expensive. So if you have a grasp of what you're doing, I'm not addressing that particular situation. Sometimes people buy expensive cars because it creates a payment, and that payment creates pressure, and that pressure creates mother of invention, and that can help you find your destiny. Like I always said, James Brown, he's always talked about the fact that he was broke and he had to do something to make money to feed his family. And so here comes R&B. There's so many categories of needful things, aren't there? When someone gains a skewed mind, they can turn into a hoarder because everything is a needful thing. Some sort of traumatic situation has got them in some bizarre loop where they're trying to preserve either the now or trying to recreate the past. Sometimes people go without and they really suffer. And so when they get plentiful again, they hoard. There's all those stories that people have been stranded on islands, and then when they come back to the mainland, they're buying food and hiding it in places because that's just what they had to do. They had to make sure the predators didn't eat the little bit of food they were able to find from some location. We're obviously not talking about that either. What the hell is up with our lust for objects? What is that? You see it in animals all the time. Selfishness sometimes plays a role between two people. Sometimes it's someone wants what you have, and other times people want to destroy what you have so you can't have it anymore. But it's something bizarre. Something strange. I had a cousin when I was a kid. He was a year and a half older than me. And he was just an asshole from birth. He's a fucking asshole from birth. I don't know what to tell you. He came over to my house. I think I was three or four years old. And he got up on top of my bed. And he got my toys. His father's a doctor. The family wanted for nothing. I mean, awesome cars, awesome house, awesome everything, clothes, food, everything. Kid got everything he wanted too at his house. But for some reason, he couldn't see me have something he didn't have. Simply because my parents had thought of a different toy than his parents had thought of. So he stood on top of my bed. I can still see it to this day. And he was, I can't remember what the hell he had in his hand. And I'm such a psychologist, sociologist from birth. I'm just looking at him like I'm studying the situation as a kid. I can't remember being angry or sad. My father caught him and he was angry. First time my father spanked the shit out of someone other than his own child. But my cousin was standing on the bed, smashing toys on the hardwood floor. And he's just, blam, just picking up another one. Blam, he was trying to break them. Because in his infantile mind, at 4 or 5 years old, he couldn't see someone having something he didn't have. So that's sort of the psychotic backside to the coin. We're going to start this episode off with us. Why do we want things that aren't imperatives, strategic resources? Of course, we need food. We need water. We need shelter. We need human interaction. I think at the tip of that, what we're really going for is some form of love with the human interaction, right? I mean, at times you've heard, you know, three's a crowd, and it's because someone's a third person, and typically, I dealt with this as a kid, typically one of the kids is insecure. can't see you being a part of the equation or the other person being a part of the equation, and he starts to attack one of the other two. I experienced this too, moving around as a kid. I had this weird kid named Charlie. Charlie was a little scrawny little kid. And he had a big brother, or at least one big brother, I guess, who must have beat him up a little bit. Probably nothing above the normal. But he joined my best friend and myself, and he just started losing it at one point. It was like one day walking to school, he just couldn't handle someone else being this dude's friend. It's really interesting. Now, there's some things that I think are psychological. You know, doctors, neurologists have studied the mind considerably in terms of the electrical patterns that fire when we eat things, ingest certain chemical combinations. Obviously, those who manufacture drugs understand exactly, at least the inventors, exactly what parts of the brain are being manipulated, and thus they handcraft the drug to do it. Usually, leaping off of some natural substance, some natural root, some natural mushroom, some fungi somewhere, and they study it and they figure it out. Well, how many times have you heard the fact that, you know, they know exactly how the electricity fires through a synaptical mesh when you ingest cocaine? And then they tell you that when you eat chocolate, it has very similar properties. I heard it as cocaine, very similar to cocaine. And then I've heard sugars similar to cocaine and caffeine similar to cocaine. And then they told women recently, and you know, I don't think you should take this to the bank, but they're telling you chocolate gives a woman a sense of sexuality, like she's in a sexual situation. Now, if that was the case, I think most women who eat chocolate would ravish their partners, and that's not occurring. So it's probably more like cocaine. So I want you to keep that in your mind as we parse through this. There are chemical, you know, combinations, 1, 2, 3 punches that happen inside your mind that will create addiction for things. Dopamine is a massive culprit of this. Gambling and reward is a gigantic dopamine pattern. All right. What happens when you look at a shiny object? If I gave you a big chunk of glass, a crystal skull or something, I say, here, hold this, take a look at this. Your mind starts to have a unique experience, doesn't it? You ever see anything that was injected in glass? You used to put roses inside, you know, glass balls. My grandmother had a bunch of these things. It's brilliant. It's beautiful. I love those things. Colored glass. Sometimes they put sand in there that hadn't been turned into glass to make it look like a little beach scene inside. But now let's take it up a notch. I give you a big diamond. One that's been cut like a baguette. So it's got just tons of sides. It's shining all kinds of overexposed light into your retina, going back to your visual cortex. Super sharp, overexposed light particles, little light verbs of ethereal particles, I should say. And your mind's getting stimulated. And you look at it and you can't get enough of this stuff. You could have a little diamond in your hand, maybe like a 2-carat diamond, and you just roll it around in your palm with your finger, right? And it's fascinating. Well, you have to give it back, unless you can come up with like 20 grand. Some people are super susceptible to this stuff. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day about successful couples. And one of the, I mentioned this probably like 4 or 5 episodes ago. Of course, who knows when this one's going to come out. It's probably 10 or 12 episodes ago. But one of the things I've noticed is that the most successful families I've ever seen do one of two things. They don't have any diamonds on their wedding rings. Neither the male nor the female have any diamonds. They just have a band. And it's usually pretty simple. The second kind are folks that married very young, follow the stereotypical, this is what you buy, 3 months of your salary. I mean, who do you think made that up? Who do you think, what, God made that up? If you love your mate, you must get in debt from the second you're born, right? But they gave themselves some rocks back and forth. Guy always gets a band. Looks like it had keys on it, right? And the woman gets a big diamond. She feels like she's really got the right man, a winner. She gets to parade around and say, I'm not broken goods. I'm not damaged goods. I'm actually worthy of being loved. That's what the ring means. It's a big show-off game during her cycle of insecurity. The guy's just sweating balls trying to figure out how to pay for everything. But eventually, they replace her ring with a nice band. And why is that? Because the woman starts to realize she can lose it. She can lose a 10 grand ring. Who wants to do that? Needful things. What's really interesting about the book's title is it's sort of a play on words, isn't it? If you watch the movie or read the book, you will realize that there's not a single item that anyone ever acquires from this gentleman who runs the pawn shop that they really need. But what Stephen King does a brilliant job doing is that the items, of which you're going to have to read the book to find out, the items match the person utterly perfectly. I don't remember a single item going into someone's hands in that book where you couldn't believe that they would feel this way about that item. And for that, he gets an A+ just for that part of the story alone. And isn't that the weirdest thing? These folks don't need these items, but they feel like if they don't have these items, they're going to die. Especially knowing that the item exists now and it's within reach, but they can't get it unless they compromise or do whatever they need to do. But until they knew it existed, they were living a perfectly normal life. And you might think I'm obsessing about the book, but it's really the way it works, isn't it? How many times have you had a shitty car and you just concede it's a crappy car? And then you drive by a new lot, a lot of new cars, you know, a lot of new cars. That's funny. You know, a new deal used car place. And you pull in it and you look at a car, and for whatever reason, it's brand new. You really can't afford it. But now all of a sudden, you're bullshitting yourself about how you can afford it. If I do this, pull up my belt. If I do that extra thing, throw a few newspapers, clean a few houses, fix a few cars, polish a few cars, whatever. Sell stuff I got at the house. I could make a few payments on this thing. I have absolutely done that. Twice. Twice in my life. Well, actually, three times. Every time I bought a car. My third car, I didn't quite feel that way about it, but I paid cash for that car, so it was a replacement for my second car, which had just ceased working. Needful things. How much have we suffered because of this concept that we have to have something that we don't need? I mean, we've argued with our loved ones. We've potentially gone bankrupt, lost relationships because we went bankrupt, perhaps just lost relationships because our dedication to this thing is so insane that we weren't willing to compromise. We sort of got drunk. We got high on the notion of this thing. And now all of a sudden, humanity falls out of our body. I have definitely have friends and family members who have suffered from this greatly. And with the internet, it got worse and worse and worse. Home Shopping Network was the preview to what the internet was going to be. For 20 years, sadly, a massive unconvicted pedophile, Jeffrey Epstein, ran the Home Shopping Network. And people were buying stuff and buying stuff and buying stuff that they didn't need. You know, yours truly. I remember buying a fruit dehumidifier. I actually used it quite a bit, but just quality wasn't there. Started not working. I like dehydrated apples. That was delicious. I was buying them by the bags, and so I finally started making them at my house. But did I need that? It wasn't that expensive, and I was rolling in it. But anyway, I know folks that have plenty of money and plenty of space. I mean, up to a point. But they start filling their house with things from their childhood. Someone in my family who had a great childhood. And so when the internet came around, eBay came around, he would buy items straight out of his childhood. And it's not that these items were, I don't know, bad necessarily, but they were items that you would never use again as an adult. One of the items I remember this particular individual purchasing, when you used to go to, in fact, I think they still have them, but when you used to go to amusement parks back in the day, you would have this machine that would bang out, it was like a little medallion, like a little coin, like a little sheriff's badge thing. And you could put in whatever you want to put in there. You just choose the letters and pound it out. It was pretty inexpensive, a few bucks or whatever, if even that, maybe 25 cents, 50 cents, depending on what decade you were using this machine. But you had a blank slug in there, and of course the center of the slug has where you are. So Six Flags Over Texas, Great America, whatever, and you pound these things out. Well, that's cool at a park because you're at the park. Why would you get these things? Because you're actually somewhere. You're at Paragon Park, Worlds of Fun. You're in various places. But to buy one and bring it to your house, well, now what? So I remember looking at this thing. I'm saying, oh, you're going to make these things in your living room? Hey, I'm in the living room. Ding, 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 1999. He's like, well, I can get slugs for it. I'm like, great. This is, if anything, it's a decoration in your house. I get it. But the amount of money paid for it was way over a decoration in your house thing. Someone might buy one of those old wooden Native Americans that you would hold the cigars out in front of a cigar shop. All right, that's a decorative thing as long as you don't pay too much for it. Or if it's really beautiful, you're paying for it. Or it's an antique, you're paying for it. Perhaps you don't want it to be damaged and thrown into some junk pile. And you got the room for it. And your house has that sort of ranch character to it. So it might make sense. You wouldn't put it in a house in California, though, would you? They have figured out that we are hunter-gatherers by nature. And so with that gene stuck deep down inside of our bodies, we have collectibles. Been around for years, right? I was here in California at the time, but I remember going back home and finding out that one of my adult relatives had been collecting Beanie Babies from McDonald's. And this is a person old enough to be my parent. And I'm thinking, really? You're collecting Beanie Babies? Like, we don't have a lot of little cousins or anything that you know. Are you giving these away to kids? I mean, what's the deal? Nope, I'm just collecting them. I almost got them all this year, and next year the new one's coming around. Ironically, Ty Warner became one of my biggest clients for my video game company. I made millions of dollars off that guy. Thank you, Ty. Any of you have ever played a card game? Like Magic the Gathering, it's a collectible game. And then it rewards you, like the Pokemon cards and all that stuff, it rewards you with more playing power. I collected in 1996 the Star Wars Decipher cards, which are utterly gorgeous, let me tell you. It is probably the most gorgeous cards I've ever held in my hand, and I've held several different types of playing systems. I still have, like, 2 full decks, but I was selling them I owned cardgames.com way back in the day. I was the first person to buy that domain ever. And I was selling them out of my house wholesale. But I was a personal fan of Star Wars, obviously. Star Wars hadn't been remade. The first 3 hadn't been made, and none of the sequel stuff had been redone or any of that kind of stuff. But I spent ridiculous money collecting these for myself. I loved this gambling algorithm of opening a pack of cards and looking for the special card. You get a Darth Vader card, man. Darth Vader cards were selling for $50 a card when that game was still active. I think I still have 5 to 10 boxes sealed from 1996, 23-year-old boxes. For some reason, they don't sell for what they're worth. It's nuts. Strange. We want control over ourselves, don't we? We don't want to find ourselves subservient to something we especially don't need. But we do. And what is that frailty in man? What is that? It might be that if you think about it, if you ate some chocolate, snorted some cocaine, all right, so now you've got a biological problem. Depending on how strong-minded you are and strong-willed you are and how sensitive you are to the substance you're ingesting, you will either have the ability to walk away or you're going to be chasing that dragon for the rest of your life. But now, what about something that you haven't acquired yet? What's going on in the brain then? Now, gamblers, I can understand. Gamblers usually always have the same beginning, which is they were casually playing one day. They pulled the arm of the one-armed bandit, which now is just a little digital button, and they won. They won $5,000 or something. Some equivalency to the 2019 of $5,000, a mind-blowing amount of money. And so then forever, if they're not strong-minded, they believe that that can happen over and over and over again. And every time you go to a casino, if you're willing to stand around for long enough, someone's going to win around you and prove to you it's possible. And technically it is. Now again, coming from the video game industry, let me tell you how they work today. They have to win a certain amount and lose a certain amount. They have to lose more than they win, but only by a percent. All of the wins and losses are calculated in a chip the day they're delivered. All you're doing is walking down all the entries in the chip until there's a win. And they know exactly how much that machine's going to take from the public and how much it's going to give to the public the day it arrives. And I mean to the penny they know. And that's what the Gambling Commission wants to know as well. I once was told, I'm not sure these statistics are correct, but I was once told that craps will allow you to win on average about 48% of the time. But even if you lose that extra 2%, you're going to be broke most of the time because you're not going to hit that, you know, 48.9% chance. And that's on certain odds, you know, of course. What is this thing? Well, we haven't experienced it yet, but by God, the thing infects our brain. You go down to your local electronics store and you see a giant 80-inch television. If you're that kind of guy, you're an electronics guy, you're just dying over it. Used to be when Apple actually had a CEO that knew something about computers, a new computer would come out. You'd see it on Steve Jobs doing it on stage. And then you would go onto the website and you go to customize and you look at that computer, you jack it all the way up and you just froth over a $10,000 Mac. You could do the same thing for a nice Windows machine these days. Some $5,500 machine. It's got everything in it. Comes with a Vive or an Oculus. Packed full of games or whatever. You're starting to lust for something that's not even there yet. Well, I think we know what the answer is, but it's still a mystery. We are having a fantasy in our mind, a prophecy inside of our head of what our life will be when we get it, all the things we can do with it if we just have it. The hoarders, that's sort of the anthem of the hoarder. It's one of two things. Well, I'm going to get around to using that. Don't want it to go to waste. Someone threw out a perfectly good thing. Or, now that I've got this, my life will be better. And that's the one that everyone else shares other than, you know, outside of just being a hoarder. I had a friend of mine teach me, and I think I've only mentioned this one time before, but it's a good time to mention this. When it comes to food, a friend of mine who was very beautiful, still is, beautiful body, she told me, I mentioned this for a reason, she'd buy something really sweet, something huge, and she had to rent a room for me for a little while, and she'd bring this home. And I'd look at her and I'd look at it and I'm like, are you changing your diet? I mean, are you going to get fat now? What is this thing you've brought? And she looked at me and laughed as she's finishing a couple bites of it. And she goes, I just buy it so I can throw it away. A couple bites and I just throw it away. I get, you know, I'm at the store. I'm seeing something I really want. Maybe something I could eat when I was a kid. So I buy it to satiate that feeling. Bring it home. I do ingest a little bit of it. But I make it a ritual to throw it away. And then I rejoice that I threw it away. Or more often than not, she'll let someone else eat it, take it to work, give it away to people, right? But she means she doesn't keep it. I started doing that a little bit. So I don't like to drink soda that much. On a rare occasion, I will drink a soda all the way through, and it's weird. Drinking a soda takes me back to like the 80s when I was a kid, and I could just pound that stuff. Today, I will, every other one, drink a little bit of it, toss the can. Pour it out, toss the can. I got my little fill, and I confirmed that it's way too sweet for me these days. What I think is great about the book Needful Things, if you read it and you have the same admiration for the story that I had reading it and still have thinking about it in the past, is when you combine my friend's regimen of buy it to get rid of the urge. Now, obviously, if it's a super expensive product, we're not going to be using this solution for that. You know, if you're rolling in the dough, I guess go ahead and toss cash out the window. I'm hoping if you have a lot of money, you can find different ways of addressing your lusts, but maybe not. But when I think about purchasing something now, I kind of do a metaphorical 10-second count. I start to try and be a cynical person about, well, I think I'm going to use it. I think I'm going to get into this new thing, this new hobby I'm talking about. But I probably won't have the time. It'll probably be difficult to learn. And so it's going to be resistance, resistance, resistance. And so half the time now I leave it in the store, if not more than that. But I wasn't like that before. I think about the needful things. I think about the lust algorithm of people looking through this little glass showcase at the thing that they want in this book and how foolish they seem wanting this thing that they don't really need, but they feel more than need. They feel an imperative to have it. I remember someone's parent, I don't remember who this was specifically, one of my friend's parents was talking about a car. And they were saying, you know, this person was very wealthy. I've even got a very close friend that's just recently replaced like a 30-year-old car, probably 35-year-old car. He got tired of spending money to keep it running even to its minimum amount. But my friend's father said, well, you know, it's just a vehicle to get me from A to B. What do I care about anything else? Now, typically in those families, the wife will be allowed, you know, the husband nearly insists that the wife have a really nice car. You know, she's always protected and comfortable. But the guy's sort of rough, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to spend my money on something else. And that sort of rubbed off on me for a little while. I'm not a big car guy. I have a very nice car right now. But, you know, before that, I just, you know, I've never been a hot rod kind of guy. I wouldn't turn it down, but I wouldn't spend a bunch of money on it unless I just had money to throw away. I don't see myself driving a car that much. My thing is get to the destination, let's do something cool. Once you become a musician, boy, you'll get some serious introductions to this course, man. If you play a guitar, man, you can't have enough of them. I swear to God, this one makes a different sound. This is a Fender. This is a Jackson. This is an acoustic. This is a 12-string. This is a bass. My hope in making this episode, even for my own sake, hearing my own voice go through this for an hour, is that we can start to identify the archetype of this lack of control and then start controlling it. Start laughing at our own urges so that we don't do it anymore. I recently had a situation where I've told you guys a couple times, I was working in the LED, the direct LED technology to try and transform our movie theaters to LED screens, which is going to happen. I've been very privileged to be a part of some of the first innovations in that technology on planet Earth. So no matter where it goes, you know, I may be one of like four or five people who have participated in engineering this stuff to get it to really, really work. And it really works. And my God, you will never go to a projection theater again for the rest of your life. But what I started to realize was that there was some technology that was missing. And just being the kind of guy that just rolls up his sleeves and gets it done, I said, you know what? I've got a pretty decent background in electronics. I need to brush up on the latest and greatest components that are out there. And so I got into the Arduino systems, I looked at the, I got a Raspberry Pi now. I got a couple Raspberry Pis, but I haven't been able to hunker down and get it done lately. But I bought probably about, I don't know, maybe like $300 worth of stuff. Not a terrible amount of money, but I needed to have a soldering station, and I needed just the, you know, breadboards and a bunch of the basic components, you know, a huge array of resistors, sort of for various components. And I started really working with this and getting really into it. And I thought, I assigned myself a project to create a robot with a very specific feature set that I think people are going to really like. And I don't know of any of them out there that do this. But then life got busy. And I started seeing myself, even though I kept it right in front of my keyboard, I started seeing myself, you know, get to my desk and I'm working on a bunch of stuff. I'm traveling around the world. And I'm losing my connection with this endeavor. Even the stuff that I had taught myself for a year to get a lot of these components to talk back to the main chip and output their serial port, out, you know, readings and all this other kind of stuff, I was losing it. I'm going to have to go back and refresh myself. It happens to every single one of us. Hobbies are interesting because they do that. And the more you experience it, hopefully you're developing a resistance towards doing it again. Now, one of the phenomenons that is going to happen, and the younger you are listening to my voice, maybe you can avoid this problem for yourself. You will amass things when you're young because you don't have anything. And you're going to need some basics, a bed, probably something to sit on when you watch television. If you want to have any friends over, it's sort of an imperative. Your cooking supplies, your toiletries, your cleanup supplies, whatever. And then you'll start garnishing your world with things that are these elective things. A stereo, a big TV, maybe a TV in general. I didn't have a TV from 1987 to 1991. And even when I had it, I only watched it when I was sick or recovering from getting my wisdom teeth pulled. I almost never watched my TV at home. But as you get older and you hit your 40s, you're probably going to go through one or two phases. You're going to keep doing it, and you're going to keep running out of space in your house. You might even upgrade your house simply to get more space to store your stuff, like George Carlin said back in the day. But a lot of folks that I am running into today, I am one of them, we're getting rid of almost everything, except the personal items of which are irreplaceable. And so, you know, old computers, old this, old that, your old clothing you're never going to wear again that has no major significance in your life. Potentially a piece of furniture that's just sitting there and doing nothing. It's not your grandmother's, just something you bought a long time ago. And there's this weird empowerment to doing that because, you know, sometimes you have to move. You have to move for all kinds of different reasons sometimes. All right. It's a lot easier when you have less stuff, isn't it? Sometimes we gain things because we feel like society thinks we should have them. There's a fairly new director in Hollywood who I've actually met him one time. Good guy. Means well. But the story went around fairly quickly after he shot his first film. He made less than $1 million for directing it. I don't know if he got points on it or not, meaning a percentage of the take. But he went off and got married and had a kid and bought several millions of dollars worth of things. Because that's what he's supposed to do in his position. And what's funny about it is if you look at the older directors, they've gone through the same thing in some cases. I've got close friends of mine who are famous directors who bought a normal house. In fact, no bigger than the one I'm sitting next to. And just kept their money. And were smart. Used it to pay for a bad year when they didn't do anything at all. And people wish this other guy, you know, the best of luck. And they want, you know, they don't want to see him fail or anything. But now people, for a while, have been very concerned about his future These things come with gigantic payments, and there's no way you pay cash for it. And so no one wants to hear the negative story about that kind of stuff messing with your life and destroying someone's otherwise wonderful life and a very skilled mind that will be now burdened from true perfection. Because you're worried about your payments, you're worried about your payments. What I like about this problem for all of us is that we all suffer from it. So as we have a joint conversation about it, we all know that we're a victim to it. Now, the only people that I think are going to pretend that they're not a victim of it are folks that have never had anything because of a poverty level that has just been over them. And they've learned to be completely content with it. But there's still that pain inside. I mentioned this in the Mr. Rogers episode, you know, about little kids feeling pain because someone has something that they don't have. I sort of kicked this off. But there's the age-old question, you know, what is your favorite possession in the entire world? You know, some of them are, you might have a few different categories. Your most sentimental object that you absolutely have to have, and those are usually fairly sensible. You know, a pocket watch from an old grandfather, something from your grandmother's, these really priceless things, heirlooms in your family. A kitchen table could be an heirloom. It's been handed down. I used to have my old girlfriend's kitchen table in that house right there, and it was a 150-year-old table. It's now probably, gosh, maybe even 170 years old now. I understand. I understand why someone would hold on to something like that. And it's a fairly primitive design. But boy, it didn't suffer. It was built right, and it, you know, hangs on. But it's those other ones. It's the other ones that we don't need that are sort of funny. Now, sometimes you can buy an item that really improves your life. Let's say you did buy a big TV. Maybe even bought some extra speakers on the side of it or something like that. And you have a large family, or you are just, your pastimes are in front of the television. And you found some good shows to watch. Maybe even just watch old movies off DVDs or streaming services. And those are very rewarding on this system that you buy. Well, that's probably not what we're talking about. Even though you didn't need it, you bought it, and you really get your money's worth. That's the fun part. When you really get your money's worth out of an object, that's probably not what we're talking about. It's the one that's sort of sitting there, staring at you. The treadmill, you know, the barbells that never get lifted. All these things that are sort of, well, my neighbor had it, I had it, I had this vision of using it. I'd never had any history of using one before, and for some reason you thought that didn't matter. We're all guilty. One of my favorite possessions that I have, let me just share, is my washer and dryer. They're Whirlpools front loaders. I bought them December of 2002 to have shipped here 2003. They have not failed one day. They have worked perfect. I mean, I don't have a lot of laundry, but still, it's 16 years later. It's still working like a charm. I don't have anything in my life besides maybe a belt buckle that works 16 years later. You know what I'm saying? It's funny because my father has a very similar set of models. And for whatever reason, of course, his wife and he do the laundry more than I do, and so he's had to replace some parts. Every time he has to replace a part, he sends me an email with exactly where he got the replacement part, what was wrong, so that if it ever happens to me, I know how to get it for, you know, a few $100 and do the repair myself. So I'm not excited to do that, but there you go. We want control. I want you to have control. I want to have control. Because money makes the world go around, doesn't it? Isn't that a sad little epitaph to our world? Humanity doesn't make our world go around. I mean, it does. I'm sort of being facetious, but the layer on top, the intellectual layer on top, we have so convinced ourselves that we are so civilized. But I think this has probably been going back since the beginning of time. Since any creature gains a sentient mind. How many times you see squirrels grab things they don't need, things that are unedible. Birds build nests out of all kinds of wild things. At least they keep most of them. But we now know that birds, like, was it pelicans? Not pelicans. Well, crows. They go off and grab jewelry. They like shiny things too. There was some story online, some internet thing online where I think, I'm not imagining this, but I think a crow or something like that brought a ring back to a woman that she had lost. It was on video. Something like that. We want something special. Isn't that weird? Why do we need these things? I mean, I think the other bird was a seagull. Yeah, they do it too. What would the world be like if we didn't have needful things? What if you just got what you needed, your strategic resources, and then anything else you add is allowable if you have the full means of acquiring it, like not taking it out on loan? I think it's amazing that when I was a kid, you were expected to be able to buy your house. You were expected to be able to buy your car. I guess I have to go back to my father's age, but it was damn near the case when I was a kid. I'm not quite that old. But now, you are not expected to be able to afford your house, your car, your kid's education. These are things that are out of financial reach. They have to be integrated into this horrible, demonic usury system where you have an interest on your loan. You're paying not only the principal of the loan, but this interest. The interest can vary. So you have to get these special loans with locked interest rates. I mean, typically your car payment doesn't change. Typically your house payment doesn't change. But if you dare refinance, oh my God. So we have some strategic resources that have to go into this weird realm, this debtor's realm. So you would think that a lot of us would just simply learn. Well, I don't want any more of that crap. And I can't afford my house and I can't afford my car in terms of its total value. So why should I spend money on something that I don't need? Now, some of you may be yelling at the video already saying, but dude, we need some entertainment. I think I'm not talking about that in some cases. Like I said, if you buy the television and you love it, go for it. Do we need $2,000 iPhones? Probably not. No matter what you think about how much you use your phone, the idea is that these little absurd pieces of plastic and metal, and maybe in the case of the broken iPhone, glass, which glass is better for recycling, but Jesus, they cannot protect those screens to save your soul. Paying $50 for a fucking glass or plastic sheet that goes over your glass. We're failing an IQ test here. We should have looked at those vendors and just said, you've got to be kidding me. A piece of plastic over my glass and you want me to charge me $50? What, you're out a cent for this thing? Why don't I just give you the keys to my car and my house while you're at it, right? Our kids are strung out on stuff right away, aren't they? Every kid has a phone, so they have to have a phone. Every kid has a some sort of gaming console, well, they have to have one. And then you have to pay for the games. If the phone exists, well, then there's microtransactions to death. Well, I want this little app. I want this little app. I want this little app. There's the monthly fee to have all that stuff. There's not a game console in the world that isn't internet-based now. What's that cost? Well, it's not fast enough. Let's get a faster internet. Don't have enough cable channels. Got to have that package, this package, this package, that package. Maybe you watch it. And you digest it and you get your money's worth. And maybe not. Let's say that there's 350 million people in the United States of America. Let's just say 150 of them are adults. I'm going to make a prediction. a silly little prediction. I think there's 50 to 70 million adults in the United States of America who are paying anywhere from $40 to $100 a month for cable, and they barely watch their TVs, but out of sheer habit, out of sheer sense of need, they continue paying for that as if their television can't stream something off the internet they're already paying for anyway. How many people ever thought we'd get rid of our home telephones? I never imagined. That thought never entered my mind. And quite frankly, I turned off my home phone without really registering the moment. It was just I was upgrading my internet package and they said, "Do you want a home phone?" I said, "No, I don't need one." And then the only thing they do to keep you having one is they'll tell you, "Well, it's cheaper if you get the home phone with it." And I'm like, "How much cheaper?" "Like 12 bucks cheaper." "All right, whatever. Throw it in there. Don't install it. I have no units that can plug into the wall. It's pointless." So there might be a layer of things that we keep out of sheer habit, but we don't need them anymore. TVs, I think, are different now because everyone can see something on their telephone. It's only when you want to have a group experience or perhaps an enhanced theatrical experience at your house that you feel like you have to have one. But now, if you were in the 90s, in the mid-90s, in the United States of America at least, there wasn't a guy on planet Earth who was, say, under 40 who hadn't thought about having a theater room in their house. If they had a spare bedroom, they would think about how to change that. In fact, when I rented this house for the first month, one of the spare bedrooms had a theater room, sort of the smallest room in the whole house. But the guy got rid of the closet and he built this sort of interesting wood enclosure inside where the closet used to be. And there was a surround sound speaker, wires hanging out of all four corners of the room. The speaker's gone. Big cable hookup behind where the TV used to be. It must have been a big tube TV. A lot of houses still have these things. But it's a little man cave. What's interesting about the sort of the marriage where you have, again, on one side of the spectrum, you've got hoarders, and it's easy to laugh at those folks sometimes. Or at least it's easy to say, I don't have any of those attributes. And then on the other side, we have folks that are, you know, like you and me, where we're just buying things we don't need. And one of the things that we say, one of the things that the hoarders say, like, "I don't think I really buy anything out of the store because I go, well, if I don't buy it, no one will, and it'll go to waste." I don't think that's not what I believe. If anything, it's the opposite polarity, which is, if I don't buy it now, someone else will buy it, and it won't be at this price, or it won't be available ever. And it actually happened to me when I was buying robotic equipment. I accidentally bought a chassis that attaches to a larger unit, and the larger unit literally went out of production. So I've got this bunch of weird parts that won't fit on anything. I'm going to have to kind of Frankenstein them together. But think about the idea of seeing something on the side of the road and picking it up and putting it in your car and bringing it home, with the notion that if you don't take it home, then it'll never be used by anyone. When the hoarder has an absolutely established record of not using anything, and so it truly dies in that little graveyard around their house or inside their house, they have assured it to never be used ever. So it would have been better to leave it on the sidewalk for someone who's going to grab it and use it. For you, the non-hoarder, let's say, it's one of these situations of you need your money. You need it. We all need it. You either need it for retirement or you need it for some event or some other instantly useful thing that you're going to use your money for. So don't microtransaction yourself to death. I have friends that self-employed, extremely stressed, complain all the time about that stress and how it affects their life and how when I hang out with them, they can't do normal things because they are just exhausted. Then they'll go off and hang out with their buddy maybe even rent a hotel room so they can kind of jump off from the hotel room and go party downtown, and they blow a bunch of cash on drinks. And of course, they're creating memories, I guess. But it's a real short-lived thing. It's an overnight thing. They come back. They've got a little bit of a shot of, oh, I feel a little bit better. But what they really needed was 10 days off in some remote location that feels nothing like where they live. It could be the desert, it could be an island, somewhere else. Their hometown, it may be far away, like me. But they can't afford it because they've microtransactioned themselves to death with all these needful things. And what I find interesting is a lot of them have little catchphrases that rationalize the temporary. And these catchphrases are extremely dangerous. And when I started season one, I tried to call a lot of them out, and I'll mention them every once in a while. And one of the most recent ones that I have heard, which facilitated substance abuse and addiction and poverty, was, well, no one gets out of this place alive, so I got to do all these things because I know I'm going to die one day. Again, what that person really needs is to save their money up, say no, and go get that gigantic relief that they really need. And it will most likely result in some inner reflection, perhaps some enlightenment of their own mind, you know, sitting there going, yeah, you know, I really did need this. I really needed to get away from everything. Maybe it's just getting away from all the electronics in a particular city. When I used to go stay at my uncle's ranch in the Midwest, man, just getting there was unbelievable. This sort of electronic pressure on my skull just disappeared. When I laid my head down at night to sleep, the echoes of my home world, full of internet signals and radio signals and just constant noise because you're in the city, it wasn't there. And it's like if you ever go to a concert and it's really loud and you come home and you feel like you can hear, you know, trumpets in your head, that tinnitus problem, and you can't sleep because you can't quiet your head, sort of a subcategory of that. Sometimes those are the benefits you can get by hunkering down and noticing. The businesses of the world have figured out microtransactions. You don't go in the pawn shop and see that one thing that you'd do anything for. You see little things all the time. Well, it's only a buck here. How many times have you had someone try to solicit charity from you? And they'll say, for the cost of a cup of coffee a day, you can feed a kid in Africa. Well, maybe for the kid in Africa, you make the sacrifice. Beware that all those frickin' agencies have now been recently exposed as probably human trafficking organizations, so be extremely careful you give your money to. I think the amount of money that a nonprofit charity has to actually spend on the actual problem that they're solving is less than 10 cents out of a dollar. Wow. And a lot of them been busted for not spending any money on the problem. There's a famous director in Hollywood who did that one with a tobacco nonprofit. He claimed he created a nonprofit organization to get rid of, you know, tobacco smoking. And they busted him after 3 years, I think, and they found out that he was spending less than 3 cents. That was the highest year he'd ever donated any money. Now, again, I never sat in a court of law to see the evidence on that, but that certainly hit the press. Could be a false accusation, I guess. But let's not do that to ourselves. Ross Perot had a great thing he said when he was running for president in 1991 or two, whatever that was. He said, you know, saving up for something that you want is probably one of the best experiences you can have. And sometimes it's better than the experience of actually buying the item. I know every single one of you, if you're over 25, you've bought something you thought was going to change your life. And you get home and within 10 minutes of unpacking it and setting it up, life went on. And that object paled in comparison to what you could have done with the money, say, 2 weeks later when you turn the key in your car and it doesn't start. And you got to spend that same exact amount of money to repair your car, except you don't have it anymore until your next paycheck. which means you're in trouble. You got to borrow money from somebody and lose face with the world. But you got that thing, right? Ladies, they nail you with fashion. How many pairs of shoes does the average woman have? How many pairs of shoes does the average dude have? We all have our strengths and weaknesses. How many electronic pieces of equipment does a woman have? How many does a man have? You know, the guy's a musician. The woman's got him dead to rights. Let me tell you, he will never be able to win that battle. Our dreams can get involved with this algorithm considerably, right? You were going to be a musician. You know you have the talent in you. You might even hear songs when you go to bed at night. You think, God, I just need to do this when I'm awake. I probably don't. You know, I heard that drum solo, but I sold my drums. I just need to get drums again. That's it. Get drums, and all of a sudden, you're going to be, a fill-in drummer for Foreigner or something, right? Whatever your band you dig. One of the biggest solids I ever did myself was starting to shelf some of those old fantasies. I just kind of go, well, had I hunkered down, you know, I would have done really well at a particular point in my life. I just had to explain to my friend the other day, you know, one of the shortcomings of yours truly is trying to find time to interact with all my friends, because I'm just busy, busy, busy. I could be in my house and I'm just like Willy Wonka. I'm like, I'm busy. I'm making the next everlasting God stop or can't stop. Can't stop to talk. They'll call me at the wrong time. I'm sleeping at a weird time. All these kind of things, right? So, you know, my focus now is screenwriting 24/7, among other things. And I was trying to explain to my friend, because there was just some discontent with my schedule. Come on, man, let's hang out. You got to find the time to hang out. This is, got to have this. And I'm like, I have all those things. I just don't have them when you have them, which you're normal. I'm not. Sorry. But I was able to tell this person, I said, look, when I was in my 20s, in the 90s, I came extremely close to breaking through where I wanted to break through in the music industry. I was sort of trying to ebb towards some of the techno that, I played country music and all kinds of wild stuff. I mean, I just played everything, but I was trying to come up with some really dirty techno, like, which ends up sort of sounding like a precursor to someone like a Skrillex kind of thing. We didn't have all that equipment to do all the wild shit he does, but I was creating this really interesting, darker techno. I just kept trying to crack it and crack it and crack it, but life just kept changing and changing on the outside. I had to study, you know, all the stuff I've told you. And I always thought, you know, I'm young, I'll find the time, da 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 da, and there it went. Now, I'm very satisfied with the stuff I accomplished musically. I'm not at that fantasy level of being satisfied with it. But so now I'm 20 years older. And now I'm focused on something that I think will not... Like, the music thing has a generational gap issue. And so my love for music was always rooted in reality of like, okay, who buys music? Kids in their 20s. What am I? Who am I? Am I going to be in my 40s banging something out? Like I said in the previous episode, probably not. And why would I want to try? You know, I need to make music that makes me feel good. And hey, if someone else digs it, then good. But screenwriting is something that has been a part of me for a really long time, almost 30 years. Professionally, I'd say 10. And I can do this until I die. Because telling good stories is just telling good stories. Now, one of the biggest mistakes I think Hollywood makes, just to go on a digression for 1 second, is that they try to target demographics too heavily. And everybody feels it. No matter if they're an expert or not, they'll feel it. And they go, oh, I see. They boiled it down because they wanted to have 12-year-olds. And they didn't really just realize that 12-year-olds aren't idiots. So instead of writing trite dialogue, they should just have boiled down the story in a way that everyone could understand it. The movies I saw when I was a kid, some of them were sort of for kids and some of them weren't. And I, you know, I saw Apocalypse Now and Warriors and my God, you know, just all kinds of stuff as a 9-year-old and Alien. Alien wasn't boiled down for me, but I saw it at 9 years old and it will stick with me for the rest of my life. I'm glad I saw it in the movie theater with my dad. So the reason I mention that is that if you have a needful thing that is related to an old dream, as long as your dream has a realistic path to it, let's say that, you know, what I just said is your dream as well. You were younger and you wanted to get into music. You know, maybe whatever you're doing in music still has an audience. Maybe you're willing to put the effort in to get back down to a younger audience. Maybe you don't need a younger audience. Maybe there are millions and millions and millions of people around the world that love what you can do, and so you might as well do it. But then maybe your thing is to throw away everything else or put it on the shelf for a long time. Maybe donate everything that was there. When I got to the point that I was going to shelf music, like I said in just recent episode, I had a $50,000 studio. And so I donated everything to friends, my brother-in-law, and, you know, he was able to sell some of it, make some money, and buy some equipment that he needed. He kept some of the equipment because it's universal for any musician. And so, you know, didn't go to waste. I wasn't the hoarder that kept it in the house thinking, well, this is a perfectly good thing, it'll go to waste. I had a buddy of mine have all their instruments stolen out of a studio warehouse, I should say. So their bass player and lead singer didn't have a bass. So I had a bass guitar. I wasn't using it. I thought I was going to dig it. In fact, I bought it off my buddy who thought he was going to learn it. And then I just gave it away. I just mailed it to him. I said, there you go. It's a really good Ibanez bass too. So anyway, I hope this connects with you guys a little bit. It's a problem I think every single one of us have. We want control. So if you're suffering from this, I want you to perk up your ears and perk up your emotions and your feelings every single time you feel the urge to get something that is a little elective. And I want you to think about the times when you can't buy the things that you need. The car doesn't start. The tire's flat. Something. You know, you need a suit because the job you're going to interview for needs you to wear one. You can't have it because you don't need money. So play all those things back. Every single time you're standing in front of an object at a department store or some other place, car dealership, whatever, and just say, can you go a little bit further with what you have? Can you save up all the money to buy it outright? And is that a wise choice for you as well? Should you have kept that money? Microtransactions, be very aware that they are now bleeding us dry. You know, it's death by a thousand, you know, scratches. Sometimes the bigger thing is the true epiphany moment of your life. You could travel someplace on a vacation and realize that you should live there. And so you just look for jobs in that area. Boom, your life changes. I took a vacation to California in June, I believe, of 1987. I wanted to know if this place was for real. And if possible, find a job. And I found both. And so when I moved here, 2 months later, I was absolutely ecstatic. I had a job lined up and a place to live lined up. And it worked out. But if I hadn't saved up my pennies, I wouldn't have seen this place. Food for thought. Food for thought. I think you feel me. Anyway, if you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. It's where you can change feeds from audio to video, video to audio. We have a locked Facebook group with some amazing people. We have a Twitter page, which just has the feed repeated there. We have a Patreon page for those who want to donate to the show. For all those hanging on in the Patreon account, just a personal thanks to every single one of you. But regardless, if you support the show in any way, I very much appreciate it, passing it around to other folks. I think there's some stuff in here that society could use. At least that's what I'm hoping. But until next time, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out. But anyway, until next time, take care of yourself and someone else. And I'll take you.